Hi, you all. You think that you all says that I'm from Southern New York. Actually, it's that my mother and father were born on this side of the Mason-Dixon line. And I was dying to ask Louise last night, but I decided I'd wait. My mother sent me away to a convent. And for 6 years, for the genteel education of Southern young ladies, I don't know whether we went to the same alma mater. I don't remember the cement. In fact, we seem to have, in a very strict place, a lot of fun. But I was going to ask her whether we had both graduated from the same convent. My name is Stephanie O'Keefe, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. And first of all, I'd like to thank you all for inviting us down here. We've looked forward to it, I guess, ever since last summer and certainly early last fall. I've been looking at license plates since I came down, and Tennessee just tells you exactly what's necessary, Tennessee. And Georgia adds the county you're from, and Alabama says it's the heart of the South. But you all have more than that said welcome, and you all come. And I hope if you do come up north that you'll all come see us. It couldn't have been maybe a worse time for us to get away, or a better time. And I had qualms about leaving at this time, and I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. I don't know if I have anything to share with you, but I know how much you've given me already. This is my story. I was saying this morning that the first time I ever stood up and said that, I proceeded to tell how my husband drank, where he drank, what he drank, when he drank. Thank God I was near enough to home that I could go back and apologize to those poor people who listened to that. And but it is my story. And if you're new in AA, please realize that as a member of Al-Anon, I'm not standing up here saying, boy, you're a you-know-what to live with, and I'm marvelous to have put up with that, because I'm not. And if you're new in Al-Anon, or even maybe not in Al-Anon, these are my opinions. These are the things that I took home. In some cases, they're the things that someone gave to me, and I applied in my own particular way. It might not be yours. If you haven't tried it, I don't think I could have, I don't think I'd be here today if I hadn't tried it and stayed with it and failed it and tried again. But don't necessarily think because I say this is what helped me that that's, you know, going to be your cup of tea. It's the idea. And I think the best thing about Al-Anon was that nobody told me I had to go out and do this. They said, this is what I did. And in some cases, I thought, yuck. And in other cases, I'm sure people who heard me thought, you did what? Your first thing may not be my first thing. Like somebody in AA, I think someone in Al-Anon has a before and after story. It's not as clear cut. And I can't say, you know, on September 9th, I had my last drink. But there is, you know, a before and after. There's even a before and after I met my husband. And don't worry, it doesn't take me a half an hour to get out of kindergarten or anything. You know, before I forget, I must say something. First of all, I wanted to thank Louise for sharing with us last night. You know, for so many years, I thought I was so special. I was listening to her talk, and there was so much that I could identify as a non-alcoholic in what she said. And it just goes to show that something that I felt for a long time, that we all suffer from many of the same symptoms of this disease. I'm the oldest of three girls, and I come from a, well, something you hardly don't see anymore, a non-drinking Irish family. And we didn't have a great deal of money growing up. Mother had come from a great deal of money, but father had spent it, I guess, before we got there. And we fought hard, you know, nice with the red hair, the Irish temper, because I blamed it all on Ray's drinking, my temper, but I had been trying to control it for years. And we fought hard as kids, and We loved hard. We used to say terrible things to each other. You know, and then 2 seconds later, may I borrow your blouse? We forgave easily. As I said, we didn't have a lot of money, but we got a lot of encouragement, particularly from my mother. If we wanted it, you know, she would do anything she could, and she expected us to do anything that we could to get it. I was always the dependable one, the sensible one, the one you could be sure, you know, would approach the thing intelligently. Well, I don't know if it was because I was the oldest. I wanted to be the oldest then. Of course, we got older. I hoped everybody thought I was younger than my sisters. But I so desperately wanted to depend on somebody else. I got tired of my mother used to depend on me. My father used to depend on me, the younger kids. I was always the sane one. I always wanted to be a little bit nutty and have somebody that I could depend on. I knew I wanted to go to college, and whereas there wasn't enough money for that, there were scholarships and fellowships and working, and if it was important enough to me, I knew I could get it, and I did. I even went to graduate school, which means I'm a little overeducated for the job I'm doing. But it was important to me, and I wanted very much to be loved, and I wanted to love. I wanted to give, and I wanted somebody to give to me. And I found this in most people. The opportunity both to give and to love, and to love and be and to be given back to in return. In any case, I got through all those years of schooling, and I worked as a high school teacher and in an executive position. And so I have no excuse here. I didn't run away and get married at 16 and make this terrible error. And I knew that there were certain things that for me would be important in a man. I knew he would have to be intelligent. I don't mean with a whole string of degrees after his name, but I knew that for me, he'd have to be smart, because I knew that I was. You know, the funny thing is that I know that standing up here, I don't look nervous, and I'm not. I'm terrified. And this is true about almost anything I've ever done. I don't look on the outside like I'm churning up inside, but I am, and my knees may not shake, but I am going through it. And I knew I was smart, but I always figured there was somebody else smarter than I was. I knew that there were certain things that I could do, but I never felt really that confident about it. I always needed to be told, you're marvelous, and Koto kept being told that. I had all the normal insecurity, although I didn't look like it on the surface. Which is great. You don't get a lot of self-pity that way, but or a lot of pity anyway. You get a lot of self-pity, I guess. But I knew that I needed a man who was intelligent. I knew that I would need a man who was strong, because I didn't want to wear the pants in our family. And I knew that I wanted a man who had a good sense of humor, because I figured, I was old enough to figure that, you know, you didn't get married and live happily ever after. There would be problems, and there would be disappointments, and there would be losses and things. And I figured, well, as long as we can see the one maybe funny thing in whatever grim situation we're facing, we'll be able to survive together. And I found him, and I got him. The first time I ever told that Ray used to love his hat, and occasionally, when he'd come home at night, he wouldn't be too careful about it, and he'd leave it someplace where the children would jump on it, you know. And I used to love that. I loved it to the point where I think after I was in Al-Anon about 3 years, I told about the times that even when he put the hat away, I'd bring it down so the children could jump on it and smash it. Because I knew he wouldn't remember whether he put the hat away or not. And I couldn't be accused of anything the next day. I was a very sneaky, mean person. He also thinks he proposed to me, but I actually got him, and I think that may be the first time he's heard that. after 18 years. And, of course, I got this very brilliant, very strong, extremely funny man, and proceeded to think for the next few years that he was the stupidest, weakest, and least funny person I had ever met in my entire life. Because I didn't like the way he drank. It scared me, and I didn't know why. If I read anything about alcoholism at that point, I couldn't apply it to us. If I heard anything about alcoholism at that point, I couldn't apply it to us. To me, an alcoholic was a bum on the Bowery, and I lived just near enough to New York City to know what the Bowery was and to know what a bum looked like. He was not a professional man living in the suburbs of Westchester County and commuting into the city. Now, when you see New York, I know what you think. You know, Fifth Avenue, Empire State Building. I've never been up in the Empire State Building. Y'all come and I'll take you up, please. but I live, we live in a little village. It's a little bit bigger than Mount Eagle. You can sneeze and cough and then you're through it. I thought I was the only person living with an alcoholic in that village. Now, if I can do this very quickly, there is a closed men's meeting on Monday night, a closed meeting on Tuesday night, and an Al-Anon meeting and an Al-Ateen meeting. There is a closed meeting on Wednesday night and an Al-Anon meeting. There is an open meeting on Thursday night. There, I think Friday's free. There's an open meeting on Saturday night. There's a Sunday afternoon and a Sunday night meeting. And I thought I was all alone. I was the only person living with this problem. Consequently, I couldn't talk to anybody about this disgrace. I might have heard sickness, but it was a disgrace. I might have been able to accept that somebody else was sick, but I just wanted him to drink normally, even to get drunk normally once in a while. I couldn't accept it as a sickness. I couldn't ask for help in Larchmont because nobody would understand. I was so unique. I was so different. I felt all alone in our house. Now, as it was introduced, and I don't want to shock anybody or tell you anything you don't know, but when we got married, as soon as possible, and in the usual way, we produced 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the pause that refreshes drink Coca-Cola, 6 and then 7 children. I think I sometimes even have to tell Ray there's 7. He goes, you know, cast through that. We have 5 boys and 2 girls. If anybody's got the same number and the opposite sex, maybe we can, you know, arrange one big wedding. one of the things when I came to Al-Anon was that I found out there were people who had more children than we did. I was sure, you know, well, that was one of the things I really felt sorriest about was not only was I all alone, but I was raising all these children all alone. But I felt alone in Larchmont, and I felt very much alone in our home. 7 kids. My father even lived with us for a number of years. To get to be alone is really an art. You have to work at it, but I felt very much alone. I didn't feel that we had this kind of giving and loving that I had hoped that at least would be the basis of our marriage. In fact, to be very honest with you, I felt as if there was a paying boarder who dropped by occasionally and who didn't pay too well, really. And of course, I felt terribly sorry for myself in my village, in my home, and I who had always known, first by force, I suppose. I had been exposed to the Catholic religion by being born into it. And going through certain years as a teenager, trying to decide whether this was the way I was going to acknowledge the existence of God, a God that For a while, I couldn't even acknowledge. And I keep hoping I can remember this as I watch our children struggle with this identification with God. I remember wondering, you know, had I been sold a bill of goods all the way down the line, was there a God? And if there were, did I wish to acknowledge his existence in this way? I knew when I finally accepted God again from my own choice, a loving God, a forgiving God, a God I felt very close to. And yet for so many years, I felt as if he had failed me, that I was alone. I went to church, and in quotation marks, I guess I prayed. Really what I did was yell at him. I said, "Thy will be done." But mostly I said, "How could you do this to a nice girl like me? What did I do to deserve this? And take it away. Make it go away. I cannot cope with it, and it's not fair." I felt so sorry for myself. And I used to cry a lot. Let's face it. Our youngest daughter, when she was under a year old, used to pat me on the back. "It's all right, Mommy." because I was the one who was crying. I felt so sorry for myself, and I saw, you know, no way out, no future, no hope. And I wasted an awful lot of time. I think that's the thing that I most remember about before Al-Anon, how much time I wasted. Time crying, time pacing the floor, time staring out the window, time planning Ray's funeral. And how stunning I was going to look in black. And how brave you all would have thought me. And of course, most of all, how he would die conveniently before anybody found out, you know. I so often hoped that I thought of doing the job myself, but knowing that I probably would get caught, I hoped that he would do it nicely without taking anybody else with him, and preferably with a large insurance policy in the background, because we had a lot of financial problems. I was fine, you know, I wasn't sick. But I had that whole funeral planned against his direct wishes, too. He wasn't going to be where he wanted to be. I was going to be in charge. But I felt so sorry for myself. And I felt very scared. Scared of what his drinking was doing to me, to our children, to our family. Scared of what was going to happen. And you know, some of the things actually happened. People called and said, "Have you noticed you haven't paid such and such a bill?" We got striped notices and green notices and purple notices, and certain essential facilities were turned off at times because we hadn't paid bills. I became an accomplished liar. Oh, the reason I haven't paid that is we've been away. Away. I'll take care of it immediately. I became also something which I thought was fine at that time, an accomplished check forger, because I did think there were certain bills that should be paid, like the mortgage. And I didn't have a checking account. I didn't have any money to put in a checking account anyway. But I was supposed to make out the checks, and Ray was supposed to sign them. But I would sign the ones I considered important with his signature. And I got very good at it. In fact, the only time the bank ever called and complained about the signature was when Ray signed his name. He had a disadvantage, I guess. But I thought this was fine. I was afraid of police, hospitalizations, things that actually happened. I can remember, though, once again, wasting time, pacing the floor back and forth and back and forth like an expectant father, not being happy with just being an expectant mother, up and down until 4 o'clock in the morning, wringing my hands, saying, how will we ever get all of these children through college? And not one of the five of them at that point were old enough to go to kindergarten. And I was concerned about how we were going to get them through college. I was not eating. I was not sleeping, worried about college. What a waste of time. I lied to protect him. I lied to protect me. I lied to protect the children. I lied because I was ashamed. I lied because I couldn't accept it as a disease. And I lied hoping that I was helping him. And what a waste of time. I used to be awfully angry. And that's not really true. I told you that I had a bad temper even as a kid. I think anger is good. If something happens that hurts me or disappoints me, at least for me, I'm a lot better off if I tell you I don't like that, rather than being the martyr. Because when I do that, I tend to be noble about it today. But believe me, next week, when you do something that's the straw that breaks the camel's back, like most women, I remember everything. And I'll remember last Saturday and whatever you did on Sunday and furthermore. I think it is kind of a feminine trait. We tend to say and then, and you know. So that for me, I'm much better off if I say to you, up with this I will not put. And even if you don't admit that I'm right, of course I am. at least I've gotten it off my chest and I am not going to feed it. So I think anger is good, even if I lose my temper. And sometimes I do out of proportion to whatever has happened. I think anger is good. It's a resentment. And I resented what I thought my husband was doing. I took that anger and I put it in a plot and I fertilized it and I watered it and I nurtured it and I let it grow. In fact, I encouraged it to grow. And maybe it's the only thing that saved me. Because I suddenly looked at myself and realized that I was way out of proportion on everything. You know, if Ray almost convinced me that if he'd lived with somebody else, he wouldn't have been an alcoholic. You know, I'm sure there are a couple of alcoholics around who have tried that approach, you know. It's that AA line, I got married and then I began to have trouble with my drinking. But I was insecure enough that there were times that I really was completely convinced that probably if he hadn't lived with me, he would not be an alcoholic. I also spent a great deal of time telling him how he was affecting our children, when the honest to God truth was I affected our children a great deal more than he ever did. And I think this is true whether just by being a mother, I am there more often. They see me more often. I have more knowledge of what goes on. They hear me more often. And they must have thought they were living with a yo-yo because I was up and down. I would feel guilty about making a federal case out of a glass, spilled glass of milk, so I'd try to go the other way. I would be mad before I got out of bed in the morning, and they would know it. I let all sorts of days and minutes go by because I had to cry or I had to be alone. And I used to try and convince my husband that he had affected our children when I know that it was I. But if I hadn't not really faced this resentment, but the fact that I didn't like me, I might never have done anything about it. I think I'd given up hope that my husband would ever stop drinking. I didn't know whether I could continue living with him. Although I didn't know where I was going. You know, you can't blame a drinking alcoholic for not listening to threats, particularly when it comes from something like me when I say, I'm leaving! Where was I going? with six preschool children. I mean, my sister wasn't sitting there saying, come stay with us. And my chances of getting a job were fairly slim. No wonder he never looked up, you know. All right, you're leaving. But I knew that no matter what happened to Ray O'Keefe, that something was going to have to change with Stephanie O'Keefe. And I didn't know what it was going to be. And I didn't really know where to go. But I suddenly realized one day, I wasn't the saint that I kept telling Ray I was. Because after all, anybody that put up with this nonsense had to be somebody really special. That I was scared. I was filled with resentment. I was filled with guilt. I was filled with remorse. I was filled with every single symptom of an alcoholic. In fact, I was as wrapped up in the bottle as my husband. And I knew that somehow or other, something was going to have to change. And I was very lucky, because I went to a clergyman who was the son of an alcoholic. And knew what I was going to say even before I said it, and said, you know, I've been waiting for you to say this for quite a while. And I said, but it's not my problem, it's my husband's problem. And he said, what makes you think that this does not affect you intellectually, physically, and spiritually? And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want out. I can no longer live with this man. And he said, fine, Stephanie. He did exactly the right thing for me. He said, in the bottom drawer over here, have the form for a separation. I said, wait a minute. Now, if he had said to me, carry your cross, I probably would have said, I want out now, and you better arrange it, and furthermore. But because he said, okay, fine, now, you know, we'll fill out this form, I said, now, hang on just a second. There is some small possibility. I have not done everything just quite as wonderfully as I thought I have. I really did think I had been marvelous to put up with this. And I had tried everything that I could think of. Tears, screaming. I even kicked him once. That trait which is so difficult and yet so effective that women do, silence. Tell your father to pass the butter. And then, of course, when you start talking, then you really start talking after all those hours of silence. But all those things that I had done to stop him drinking had been very ineffective. But I did admit that there was a possibility that there might be something else. And he suggested that I go to Al-Anon and to open AA meetings. Well, I'd like to tell you that, having this great respect for this man, and I certainly do, and love for him, I immediately did what he said. But I didn't think I had time to get into the city with all these young children, get down to the Bowery to get to these meetings. So I put it off for a while, and of course he was, I suppose, my Al-Anon for a while. And even when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, I knew I wasn't going to like it. I knew all about it. I'd never been to one before, but I knew what it was like. First of all, it was a gossip session, and I hadn't even told my own father that my husband was an alcoholic, so I wasn't about to tell a bunch of strangers that I had nothing in common with that my husband was an alcoholic. And I really figured it was going to be like, you know, can you top this? Oh, you think that's bad? Wait till I tell you what he did last week or what she did yesterday. And I just was so loath to say anything about it that I just knew that I wasn't going to like this at all. Of course, I found out that they didn't care whether I was living with a sober alcoholic or a drinking alcoholic. They wouldn't know what I was doing. In Al-Anon, and certainly through open AA meetings, I learned an awful lot about alcoholism. I learned an awful lot about the things that I had been doing that were a waste of time. It says in some of our literature that it is possible that if the family of an alcoholic can change their attitude, that it may help the alcoholic to admit and accept his problem. I had so much attitude to change. I learned a great deal about the problem of alcoholism, but I learned a great deal more about me. Because essentially, it didn't really matter in the long run whether Ray O'Keefe got sober or not. It was me and what I was, because I was the only person who could change me. And Ray could not do that, and I could not do it for him. And that's why I stayed. And that's why I feel that it has helped me. Not only because I learned a lot of things, you know, don't bother. I didn't pour liquor down the drain. It's not because I was so smart, it's because I was so cheap. But most of those things that all of us did, I did. And whether it was a male or a female. And it wasn't only that I learned, all right, to say, I cannot, this I won't tolerate, rather than letting anger build into resentment. To live one day at a time. All right. He wasn't going to be at that kindergarten graduation or that first communion or at that trip to the beach, but we could still have a good time. It might not be the way I wanted it, but it was going to be a perfect day. And when things got me down, there were things that I could do when I was depressed or resentful that helped me get over that period. There were times when I was so uptight that I used to pray the serenity prayer to give me the serenity to really say the serenity prayer. For me, if it on a rotten day means taking the linen closet and tearing it apart, and it's one way to work off my frustration, and it's not yours, don't worry. If for me, I can go out and take a tennis ball and hit it as hard as I can, and you think I'd rather hit a golf ball, by all means do. It was me learning what the tools were for me. Sometimes there were things that could not be changed by hitting a tennis ball or vacuuming. But I learned that I could live and enjoy. You know, you all gave me back my sense of humor. Life was grim, really grim. And I discovered that there are funny things that happen even when somebody in the family is drinking. And if anybody had ever told me, there were three things, I think, that if my husband were drinking, or anybody in my family were drinking alcoholically, that I would be able to eat, sleep, and laugh, I would have said never, absolutely never, because that's how I reacted. You know, some people, when they get upset, they're eating like this. I didn't eat at all. Some people sleep to get away from it. I paced. And there are funny things that happen, and I never thought I'd be able to laugh. I was a steward, and, you know, when I'd wake up in the middle of the night and he wouldn't be home, I'd think, I never thought, you know, he's at somebody's house, apartment. He was hit over the head in the subway. They took his identification. He's dead, and they have no way to reach me. I mean, that's great. You know, a lovely bedtime story. Guaranteed to put you to sleep again. If somebody could say to me, I could wake up in the middle of the night and think, ooh, last train, please, dear God, take care of him, clunk, and go back to sleep, because I had to, or I wouldn't have been able. I was getting to the point where I was so thin, so without sleep, that I couldn't take care of the kids. You told me that I was powerless over alcohol. Now, first of all, that's the greatest time saver you ever gave me. I didn't have to plan, manage, beg, plead, yell. I was powerless over alcohol. And my life had become unmanageable. That was a little harder to accept, Saint Stephanie. But when I think of all the things that I had done, crazy, insane, sick things, how silly it was not to admit that my life had become unmanageable. And to go back to a God I had known, a God I had really cursed, and said he had failed me, and say, here, I've tried everything that I know how to do. This problem is yours. To feel that same closeness to God that I had known for years. To know his love again. And to know that God hadn't moved, only Stephanie. That I had really forgotten how to pray. That I had really not said, thy will be done. It seems to me that steps 4 through 10 are kind of the roll-up-your-sleeve steps. The first 3 and the last 2 are more between God and me. And certainly 4 through 10 are between God and me, but they're more action. They're something that I can sink my teeth into. You know, when I read the 4th step, I knew I was home. I'd taken it so often, foray, and so magnificently. I knew every one of his faults and could list them in alphabetical order, probably. And in the 4th step, they asked me to take my own inventory. I think the first time I took it, I was fairly honest, except back in crept that old insecurity of mine. I had done nothing right. Well, there were things I had done right. And I finally got a fairly honest appraisal of my good points and my bad points. And I think I would have made that nice little list and stuck it in my bureau drawer, and it'd still be sitting there. If it weren't that you asked me in the 5th step, not only to tell God, but to tell one other person what my faults were and my good points. And I picked an awfully good person to tell. Because every now and then when I would say to her, you know, I'm going to work on such and so, and I'd meet her at a meeting, she'd say, what was that again you're working on this week? I don't see it somehow or other. I think I would have let that list rest there if it had not been for telling somebody else. Because then it seemed to me as if you knew, and you knew whether I was working or not, and it became a matter of pride. I was obviously going to fail, and maybe I wasn't always going to tell you when I failed. But at least I had that feeling that because you knew, I would have to try again. In beginning to make amends, it sounds conceited if I say that one of the first people that I had to make amends to was myself. But as in most things, we mostly hurt ourselves. And if I was going to get through today, I was going to have to learn again how to eat and how to sleep, if nothing else. Because otherwise, physically, I could not survive. And therefore, it was important that I certainly be up near the head of that list as far as making amends, in that way at least. In the way of forgiving myself for my faults. because otherwise I would have become so bogged down in guilt that I never could have tried. And I certainly owed amends to my family, to my husband, to our children, to our friends, to all those people I lied to all those people who I couldn't listen to because I had such a terrible problem. This morning after breakfast, I excused myself from the breakfast table. You know, I didn't dare hope, knowing I was coming down here, who was going to be here that I knew. And I can't tell you how glad I am that the people who are here that I know are here. And they know me pretty well, even if they don't see me we don't see each other very often. But as I was leaving the table this morning, two people that I have known for a long time, I said to them, well, I think I'm going to go leave for a few minutes and take the 11th step. One of them said, why don't you try the 10th? And I said, I'd already done that. Now I wanted to be alone with God. And the 10th step, to me, has taken on such a different meaning in the last few months. About 4 years ago, we had one of those big crisis kind of things. You know, tune in tomorrow and see what happens. I was flat on my back in one hospital bed with tubes and bottles, and the baby was in the nursery, and they were saying, we cannot give you any hope that this baby is going to live. And the phone is ringing, and they're saying, your husband has just been admitted to such and such a hospital with a heart attack. And, you know, you really did. You wondered how it was all going to turn out. But big things like that, it was the first big thing I guess we'd ever really had since the two of us had been in this program. And I thought, I can do it. I can say the Serenity Prayer. I'm even going to be able to get a certain amount of sleep because I have to, no matter what happens. There's very little I can do about any of these situations. I'm not a doctor. And no matter what happens, I've got to take care of this moment so that this will end. And the great thing about a crisis, a headline thing like that, is that it has a beginning and a middle and an end. And no matter how it turns out, you know that someday you're going to be able to tie it up in a nice, neat little package. And I really think it's almost easier to apply these principles in something like that than it is on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, living. Because it doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end, or at least not, you know, a foreseeable one. I started out to say I thought the 10th step was so important because I realized on those days that for something big, I could apply these principles. But I found myself in a situation about a year ago that was not big, had no beginning, middle, and end, was very real. But I realized in taking the 10th step that at least for me, my reactions were not right for me. The fact that I had allowed myself to slip into self-pity or even be riddled by resentment again was something I could face. My reaction was something that even though I knew was wrong, I seemed to go ahead and do anyway. The fact that I could even face my resentment and self-pity and inevitably the fact that my reactions were wrong for me was only possible through the 10th step. Nobody could have forced me to see it. Nobody maybe could have made me see it a day earlier. And the fact, you know, I said I was awfully glad I came down here because though I had faced that much of a situation, I had begun to anticipate again. There will never be any possibility for me to make amends. I will never be able to live 24 hours, taking each day, each incident as it happens. And I suddenly thought yesterday, when we stopped to look across a valley, that that may well be true. But that's not my problem. I can live 24 hours a day. And I can forgive and be forgiven. And for that one moment alone, I wouldn't have missed this trip to Tennessee. You know, when you talk about the 11th step, unless you're a lot better than I do, you sound awfully pious when you say meditation, closer contact with God. If you lived in a house with 7 children and a number of animals that also sometimes becomes a halfway house, and you think of 15 minutes a day by yourself, that's not pious, that's an art. And it's something that is, for me, absolutely essential. I spend so much time during the day with people, not doing big things, but distracting things, never really finishing one job before the telephone rings or I have to pick up or this one is going there. And it's a constant shifting, remembering what I said. Sometimes I find myself, yes, yes, yes. What did you say? Yeah, oh, no, you can't go off and play on the roof, dear. the trying to give individual attention to a mob of kids. It's not pious for me to talk about trying to spend a few minutes alone improving my conscience contact with God. It is essential. And certainly, if this is not a retreat, it is a roundup. Not only one of the gifts that you have given me this weekend is what you have shared with me, but the gift of giving me the time to be alone, which is so hard for me to grab at home. We say that we will practice these principles in all our affairs. And in fact, in the 12th step, it is the only step that is different from AA. We say that we will carry this message to others. There was a now dead Catholic prelate who said, I think very wisely, saints may be all right in heaven, but they sure are hell with to live with on earth. No one will ever have to worry that I will achieve perfection. I am not a saint. And thank God I don't want to live with one either, because I think that Catholic prelate is right. We are all going to fail in practicing these principles in some of our affairs. And every now and then when, you know, I stand up here and, or someone says to me afterwards, you know, thank you for such a wonderful speech and how do you ever do that? I'd lie to you, I have been trained in public speaking. But if I get up here and give the most magnificent speech in the world and my family wouldn't recognize me, it's worth zap. And if I get up here and give you the most fantastic lecture on the 12 steps and I can't say I'm sorry to our oldest son when I'm wrong, then that's a lecture. And if this is not my story, it doesn't really matter how well I tell it. If I am not honest with myself and with God and at least one other person, then it doesn't matter, because the person who should be helped most by me standing up here is really me. It's a special chance to take the 12th step, I mean the 4th step. It's a special chance to face myself. And hopefully there's one other person in the room who's suffered the same kind of guilt or gone through the same kind of remorse or fear or resentment or self-pity that I have. After I came into Al-Anon for a while, and I was an Alateen sponsor for 5 years, I approached Alateen with the same modesty that I came to Al-Anon. I thought I'd save these kids and give them the benefit of my, you know, vast maturity to discover that many of them lived in situations much worse than I had ever known at a much younger age and were demonstrating at 13 greater maturity than I was showing at 30. Well, once again, I learned that not was I giving, but boy, was I getting. And boy, were they sharing with me. When a friend of mine volunteered me down to WSO, and believe me, I thought, well, I don't really know what I thought World Service Office was. But I was sure I wouldn't like it. But that also they would benefit by my presence and my talent. I think of all the wonderful people I got to meet. I don't suppose I ever would have met either Bill or Lois if I hadn't gone down there. Or the author of One Day at a Time, or the author of The Forum, or even delegates from a lot of southern states who have given me so much. I do think that all of us have a responsibility to carry this message. And I think all of us are great once that phone rings, and all of us maybe have to take another little extra effort to make sure that those people who don't know of the existence of AA or Al-Anon or Alateen are able to find out. Years ago, there was a show on Broadway, which I saw as an infant, Mommy Carried Me In, that had a song in it that I've always loved. And I don't sing, no matter how late at night I stay up, so don't worry. But the title alone seems to me to say what I feel about these steps, about all of you, about what you've given, about today, and the 24 hours we have to live, about the gratitude I feel. With these tools, with God as we understand Him, and with this program, and with all of us, as the song says, you will never walk alone.